This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. In December 2012, Cuban-American poet Richard Blanco learned that he was chosen to be the fifth inaugural poet of the United States. The appointment is different from the Poet Laureate of the U.S. in that the inaugural poet is specifically asked to write and read his or her poem at a presidential inauguration. Mr. Blanco would be one of many firsts for the role, the youngest, the first immigrant, the first Latino, and the first openly gay poets.
Blanco drafted three poems for President Obama's second inauguration in 2013. One Today was chosen. Since then, he's read other poems for public events such as memorials for the Boston Marathon bombings and the reopening of the U.S. Embassy in Cuba. In 2015, the Academy of American Poets named Blanco its first education ambassador.
Ahead of a Saturday evening event at Centennial Hall at the Milwaukee Public Library, he spoke with Lake Effect's Mayan Silver and explained how poetry transforms the ordinary into the extraordinary.
Well, poetry makes us slow down and pay attention to things and really pause and focus on those things that seemingly pass us by every day as inconsequential or that our minds are actually registering subconsciously. And it's much like a meditation. You know, when you slow down your mind, you see the finite beauty and so many other things that you're not paying attention to. And so part of what I try to do in a poem is to sort of slow down time and freeze a moment and just make us realize how that quiet moment really speaks to something very infinite and important in our lives. The classic example of something like that would be one of the shortest, most famous poems of the 20th century, The Red Wheelbarrow by William Carlos Williams, in which, you know, just realizing how much a wheelbarrow really echoes with meaning in the context of what he's looking at in our lives, right? So that's kind of part of what poetry does or can do, is to take the seemingly ordinary and realize how extraordinary life is all around us in ways that are often very surprising.
How do you personally take the ordinary and make it into poetry?
By detailing it, by meditating on it, and drawing out the sights, the sounds, the moments of whatever it is you're looking at. I'll give you an example. So, you know, how many times have I watched my mother cook dinner, you know, and not sort of paid attention? So it's been 20 years of watching my mother cook dinner every night. And one night I was just realizing how meaningful that is and how powerful that moment has been in my life that I've sort of just passed over, glossed over all my life. And I wrote a poem about it. I mean, I wrote a poem detailing every single nuance of that moment, a slow motion replay of that moment.
Do you think you have something, a special character that allows you to notice and make observations necessary for poetry, or is this something that people in general can draw upon?
Both. I think as a child, I was a very sort of self-conscious child. Not necessarily introverted, but very self-conscious, partly because of my grandmother, who was so homophobic, and so she was constantly sort of always watching me. And so I became sort of an observer of the world instead of a participant, sort of very cautious about what I said or did. And so in some ways, inadvertently, my grandmother, in her own odd way, made me a writer in a way. Because writers do sort of pause and sort of pay attention to the world, and it's sort of train yourself to do. And to do that, you have to sort of almost step back a little bit, right? So I think I developed that kind of skills of observation and observing people and actions and human nature since a very early age. But it's not anything that someone can train themselves to do at any age. And I think when we take writing courses, that's one of the things that we develop, the powers of observation, and to realize that things that we look at, again, are not, you know, they're not just taken for face value, but there's always deeper meanings in our actions, our words, and the objects of our daily lives.
You were talking about your grandmother and how she affected you, and you've also described yourself as made in Cuba, assembled in Spain, and imported to the United States, growing up in Miami in a close-knit community of Cuban exiles. So how did you draw upon that experience as an immigrant of Cuban heritage in your poetry?
very early age, the question of home, question of country and place and identity was basically with me since, like it says, before I was even born, you could say. My mother left Cuba 7 months pregnant, and then I was born in Madrid, and 45 days after I was born, we immigrated to the United States and eventually settled in Miami. So just as a little kid, that, you know, the community and well, the nuclear family as well as the larger community, you know, this is the talk of almost every dinner and every gathering was, where, you know, what's going on with Cuba? Are we going back to Cuba? What's going to happen? You know, what is home? Or, you know, are negotiating their jobs here in the United States and what they were going to do and how are their lives going to unfold here. So I felt very, since a very early age, sort of just surrounded by these questions. And that, I think, instilled in me a theme for the rest of my life in my poetry, which is what is home. And it doesn't necessarily, you know, it's larger than just the Cuban-American context, but rather, you know, home is a universal question. To think of it, it's something we all ask ourselves in some way, shape, or form. The idea of belonging, the idea of returning home, of finding home, is a theme that we find, you know, since the beginning of literature, right? I mean, we have Homer. So, you know, I've used their experiences as a tangible way of discussing these themes of home, which are, of course, a little less tangible.
And you talked about the homophobia that your grandmother had or potential xenophobia. What are some of the ways that poetry and creativity has served as healing for you and helped you figure out your identity?
Sure. I don't always like to use the word healing in poetry because I think it implies that poetry is about answers, resolution. But poetry is about just asking really good questions about yourself and the world. I had a professor of mine once said that good art answers questions, but great art asks them. So the idea that it makes us, again, pay attention to our lives, that in and alone itself is of great value. Doesn't mean we necessarily heal, but it means we become more aware of ourselves and who we are and the context of our lives. And certainly that with my grandmother or with any other of a dozen or two dozen sort of topics in my life, memory, home, things like this, that we can go all our lives without really questioning memories or these events or these notions. And poetry makes us stop and pause and think about them. And, you know, it's not necessarily about finding an answer and moving on. It's about living in the question, very powerful. So as Anaïs Nin said, to paraphrase, Anaïs Nin said that writers taste life twice. What's meant by that is that when we write, we go back through those fine details and we really add context and meaning to our lives and understand things. And if that leads to healing, of course, that's perfectly plausible. I'm not saying poetry doesn't heal, but the object is an investigation first and not necessarily the act of healing. And for that, healing for me is more like when one goes to therapy or stuff like that. And I've been to plenty of therapy as well, so I know the difference.
So you actually received your engineering degree and studied engineering before you went back to school for a master's in creative writing.
Mm-hmm.
So what prompted you at that time to turn to poetry and creativity?
A couple things. One is I didn't necessarily have an aha moment and realized I studied the wrong thing and hated engineering and left engineering. As I often like to joke, I tell people, well, you know, I was really tempted to go to poetry because there was so much money in it. I decided to stay in engineering. I've been an engineer, a practicing professional engineer all since my degree, basically all my life. So I've not abandoned one. I've just added poetry to my resume. So
yes.
But going back even further, you know, I was always one of those left-brain, right-brain kids. I loved everything. I loved math. I loved art. I loved music. I loved sciences. And so when it came time to decide a major, you know, obviously our society in general and my family, you know, encouraged the more traditional careers. And as an immigrant family, even more so, the working class family, you know, doctor, lawyer, engineer were the things that they encouraged. And, you know, the whole, you know, you're going to have a better life than we had kind of thing. So that was one dimension of my initial decision to study engineering. I loved and excelled in math, even better. I was better at math than English, I was, that's for sure. And also, there was another factor, which was my grandmother. So my grandmother, with her homophobia, you can imagine how it would have gone over in the house. And I should say she lived with us for 10 years. If I would have said I wanted to study painting or literature or something like that. Mm-hmm. So that was another sort of factor. And then the other was a cultural sort of divide. My parents didn't know Robert Frost or Allen Ginsberg or any of the sort of literary or cultural or artistic traditions in the United States. So they couldn't support my interest even if they could or wanted to. You know, they knew their Nicolas Guillén and Rifeo Olam and the art of Cuba and that sense. So those three things sort of affected me in my initial decision. And I became an engineer, and very happily so. But I always knew I wanted to do something creative at some point in my life. I didn't know what that was. I thought maybe it would be architecture. But somewhere along the line, I started writing. And then in a weird way, it was engineering that led me to writing. There was a lot of writing involved in a consulting office in engineering. About 68% of my job was writing reports and studies and letters and all sorts of oral and written communication skills that you really had to master. And I just had an experience with language and realized that language was something that was very much engineered, that language was something that was malleable, that language was something living and something that was alive in the world. And I just fell in love with language, and then from that moment forward, I just started fooling around with poetry, so to speak, and just thought, well, what else can I do? How else can I investigate language, and what better way than through poetry? And so I went on, and just it was really just following my creative and intellectual curiosities. I didn't necessarily think I was going to have a career move or anything like that, and I just started taking workshop classes at community college, and then eventually applied for a master's program in creative writing, and et cetera, et cetera. And the rest, as they say, is history. But I've been practicing engineering. I'm still technically employed. Technically, I'm still an employee of my firm, even though I haven't been able to do any engineering for 3 years since the presidential inauguration role. So yeah, that's kind of how it happened. It was very serendipitous and sort of unplanned. And isn't that, when we look back on our lives, isn't that how most things happen?
Yes, definitely. And you mentioned the inauguration, as you were the fifth inaugural poet of the United States for President Obama in 2012. And I wanted to ask you something particular about this. You wrote in your memoir that when you were young, and I'm going to quote this, the true American boy seemed like someone else, not me exactly. And yes, so I'm wondering how the experience of the inauguration and that universality of your message, how did that affect your feeling of you're not being Americanness?
Growing up in Miami, in a way, I grew up in a very undiverse community because diversity is relative, right? And so everybody in my community was Cuban, pretty much, you know, from across the whole socioeconomic spectrum. So the gardener was Cuban, but so was the mayor. The doctor was Cuban, so was the butcher. So in some ways, America felt like this other place, this other sort of real and imagined world, much like Cuba felt on the other end, because, you know, my parents and grandparents and family and the community would talk about Cuba and this and that, and there were letters and photos and all this stuff of this place that we were from, but I had never been to. So America sort of felt that in some ways the same way. And so I contextualized my sense of America from what I watched on TV for the most part and TV commercials and thinking, someday I'll go to the United States finally. But what all that meant is that I never really, I kind of felt even to in my 40s that to be American was some other kind of narrative that I didn't belong to. And the experience of writing the poem itself, of delivering that poem, of being asked to serve in such an incredible role and be honored in such an incredible way, and partly of the president's own spirit of inclusivity and everyone, not just certain people, just had an aha moment. I was like, wow, you know, I am America. You know, this story is my story. It's the story of my mother is an American story, and the story of my grandparents, and all immigrants, and all LGBT people, and et cetera, down the line. And I realized that that was always been part of the American narrative. It was just a narrative that was never acknowledged. And that moment, I just felt like it was being acknowledged for me personally, but for also for millions of people and kids who probably felt like me, like, I'm not really America. You know, I'm not really part of the United States. That's something in a history book with a bunch of men in white wigs, you know? Mm-hmm. So, it was life-changing in that sense, because I just realized that I did belong. It was in a way, home was in my backyard, so to speak, all along. I realized that I have a right to claim my place in America and to have my place at the American table. And all that was because of that whole experience of the inauguration. And if you look at the poem, One Today, the poem that I wrote and recited, it really is about that. In some ways, it's about how we all have a place at the table. We all belong. We all belong to America. From the mothers at playgrounds to truck drivers to doctors to lawyers. You know, that we all belong to that narrative, and that we all are home.
And one of the other things that I noticed in your memoir, you talked about your Cuban relatives and the fact that many of them have a high school education at best, but yet they know their national poets and can quote from them. So you wrote that poetry is entrenched in their history, rooted in their folklore, established in their national identity and their very lives. So after that experience at the inauguration and becoming a poet that is known to the community and you have an awareness for poetry, what are some of the things that the United States can learn from Cuba in terms of our attitudes towards poetry?
That was with my relatives in Cuba and my very first trip to Cuba. They asked me if I was a poet, and I said yes. And they brought out a guitar and a bottle of rum and said, sing to us. Then, you know, the idea of poetry and song and music that hadn't been disconnected. What I realized through that process, and again through the inaugural process, was that part of the disconnect of poetry in America, which I don't think always was, and part of it I think has to do with education. I think we teach poetry more as an analysis than as an art. My experience, I mean, I never read a living poet in all my education, for example. And then we also sort of start with Beowulf, and, you know, we also don't teach poetry that's relevant at the moment. And it's not to say that the classics, that they're not worth teaching. Of course, they're worth teaching, but that's usually all we get. And so for a 13, 14-year-old, it's kind of hard to connect with that stuff. And we should teach it. Billy Collins sort of talks about this, too, that we need to teach it the other way around. Begin with the contemporary stuff and save the more complex canonical texts like Beowulf and Shakespeare for when we're in college, when we can really sort of wrap our heads around it in a more significant way. And also when we realize that poetry is something that's still being written, that is still relevant, we have a different appreciation for the poetry of the past. So I think it all comes down to how we're handed poetry. And I'm not here to blame teachers or anything like that. They are, God knows, they're angels, you know. But they were probably taught the same way, too. So it's a weird thing in America. We see poetry as something rarefied and something that's just lofty and for other people. And in Latin America in general, besides Cuba, that's a very different attitude about poetry. I'm not saying everybody walks around quoting poetry and that they read poetry every day, but they're certainly not scared of it. They realize that poets and that poetry holds a different place in their lives, and that poets hold a different place in their society. If you look at, not long ago, I went to Nicaragua, to Managua, and in their central plaza there, I mean, there's a huge monument to Rubén Darío, you know, his poet. So, you know, the idea that the wisdom of words that poets impart is part of their society and something they pay attention to. So I think that disconnect in America has happened. I don't think it was always like that. I mean, if you ask older generations, they know their poetry. They know a little bit here and there, and they aren't as scared of it. I think it's happened in the last few decades where there's a disconnect in the educational system, and I think poetry should be taught more as an art that should be allowed for more emotional response and not just analysis. And I always use the analogy that you don't take an art history course and learn how to paint, right? And yet, you know, English courses, it's really like three courses all crammed into one, right? It's analysis, it's also an art, and it's also you're supposed to learn how to write in that course as well. And so I think in some ways it gets very blurry in there, and I think we don't always have or are given the opportunity to be with poetry in ways that matter in the long run. So I think that's basically it, you know, the lesson. It comes from education. That's certainly what I realized after the inauguration. Many people who wrote to me or were stopping me in the streets in Washington would say, you know, we really loved your speech. And I realized that they had been so ingrained to believe that they could never get anything out of a poem, that a poem was something that they could never connect with, that they were afraid to call it a poem. And that was really eye-opening. And ever since then, I've dedicated a lot of energy and time to helping educators have their experience with poetry so that and have their enthusiasm with poetry that can hopefully rub off on their students. I mean, after all, you know, some English teachers themselves admit that they're scared of teaching poetry, and National Poetry Month comes along and they all freak out, you know, and it's sort of having a math teacher or an algebra teacher trying to teach algebra when he or she is afraid of math. If you really think about it, the equation doesn't work. So I've been working a lot with the Academy of American Poets, who is the premier organization that serves specifically educators with lesson plans and thoughts about poetry and ways that they can connect with poetry and have their students connect with poetry. And I'm serving as the education ambassador also for them, trying to spread the word of all the good work that they do. And it's really amazing. I've seen what happens in a classroom, both for the teacher and the student, when they suddenly have these aha moments with poetry and realize it isn't some rarefied thing written 100 years ago by some person in England, you know, that there's so many wonderful, amazing poets writing today about, and a diversity of poets writing about issues of almost anything that you can think of or any community. There's poetry about it. And that poetry is something that's not just for an English class. It's for social studies. It can be used for a civics class. It can be used in history class. It teaches us way beyond English courses.
You started a blog with a friend, or with Behar, called Bridges to and from Cuba, Lifting the Emotional Embargo. And so I was wondering, what are your emotions as you think about next month's visit by President Obama to Cuba, which is the first presidential visit in 88 years?
Yeah, well, I'm hoping to go with him. I think it's a very bold move. I think it's something that's pretty important. I think he's taking a big chance, but I think it, like all chances, with the hope that it'll pay off. I think what he's really going for, as he has stated, is, you know, hopefully to stimulate more changes. I think he feels a little unsatisfied with their part of the bargain, so to speak. In that sense, I'm hopeful that his visit will break down more walls and will create real and more meaningful changes in Cuba as part of what this whole re-engagement with Cuba process has been about. So I'm just hopeful. That would be the emotion. I'm hopeful that, much like if we look back in history at Nixon's visit to China, that this will stimulate all sorts of perhaps things that aren't even tangible right now, but that lead to change and better communication and understanding between the two countries. A lot of what I feel personally is that change, much like poetry, you know, is something that sometimes not completely tangible, but that it has ripple effects in ways that we can't always predict or measure. And I think this sort of gesture, I think, will mean a lot to the people of Cuba themselves, and it means a lot to the world, and I think it will have a lot of ripple effects, positive, I hope.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Richard Blanco, for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Cuban-American Richard Blanco is the fifth inaugural poet of the United States. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mayan Silver.